Welcome to the Peace Wanted podcast.
We've been able to invite Winnie Bedigan to come along. Winnie was my PhD student, so thank you very much for coming.
You're welcome.
What you might not know is that some of the things that I learned from you doing a PhD, I have constantly told other people all about. You might not know that. So telling people about how you talk about the idea of traditional conflict resolution and the challenges that sort of like your own experience and how that fitted into what you learnt by that. So I'm always telling people about it. So one of the reasons I'm so happy is to hear more about it and what you've done with all of that experience in armed conflict from you.
Wow. That's interesting. I would like to know those bits.
You tell it to. So, I mean, do you want to start by, like, can you tell us a bit about, I mean, you're from South Sudan. So growing up in South Sudan, why did you end up wanting to do research about it in a PhD?
Wow. Thank you so much, Rachel. I think I am because you were, or because you are. That's the Ubuntu word. If you guys heard about Ubuntu, you know, you made me, you know, to be who I am right now. So I really appreciate, you know. So I finished my PhD 2017, but as you can hear from my accent, you know, African, strong African accent. Yes, you are right. I was born in South Sudan, lived there until around the age of around 5. And then because of the civil wars, you know, my parents moved to Uganda. So that's where I grew up and had my education. So what made me do PhD in peace building or conflict resolution wasn't actually something that I'd thought earlier on. First, when I came to the UK, actually I did a degree in computer science for first year degree. And then it became actually hard for me because they wanted, you needed to be able to be doing programming, you know, and programming language had become quite hard for me. And that time I'd had my first phone, so it wasn't easy for me. So I went for a postgrad fair. So that's when I came across, you know, courses, and one of them sounded really very interesting, and that was peace building and conflict resolution.
That's right.
Yes. I read that and I was like, what's this course all about? You know, so when I read it, I felt so interested. I said, can I apply for this course? Yes, then I applied for it. So then I did master's, MA in, I think it was peace and conflict resolution, they call it. When I did that course, my mind opened a lot. You know, somebody who grew up in Africa, I didn't know much about Africa. I didn't even know about these wars, actually, the causes and all that. But doing that course opened my mind. I remember when we were with the late Steve, you know, Professor Steve. And then, of course, Dave Davis, not here. I didn't know much about, you know, the causes, the conflict, the interconnectedness of conflicts and peace building, etc. So we learned about East Timor and then, you know, some other places. And the more I learned about conflicts and peace issues, the more I got interested, you know. So when I finished, of course, my MA, that's when I developed a more interest on getting to know more, because at the master's level actually introduced me to the role of United Nations, you know, African Union. So I was like, so why is United Nations always getting it wrong? You know, what is really the problem? Why are there civil wars and all that? So what I did then was to think about, of course, South Sudan, because South Sudan actually has been going through civil wars since around 1955. Remember, South Sudan was one of the British colonies. So when the British left in 1955, they handed over power to the Arabs. Remember, the British used to use like indirect rule. So because the Arabs had already the set-up system, so they handed over power to the Arabs. And, you know, there was always that conflict between the Arabs and then the black Africans, because you'd say maybe racism, I would say, the Arabs. There was a lot of slavery of the black Africans, etc. So and then the Muslim, you know, Islam as well, you know, the Muslims in the Arab North, I mean South Sudan, Northern South Sudan, they wanted to kind of convert the Christians in the Southern Sudan, and the Christians in Southern Sudan didn't want that. You know, so there was always that wars, apart from the political issues that was going on about the governance. In fact, by that time, you know, South Sudan had not yet split into South Sudan. So issues, political issues and all that. So war has always been in South Sudan, you know. So people like myself, we grew up in war, experiencing war, until sometimes you felt like it was like supposed to be like that, you know.
Yeah. Like it was normal.
Yes, like yeah. It was normal. So around that time when I finished my master's, of course, I became so much sensitive to some of these issues. Yeah. But then obviously, when you listen to like BBC reporting and what, it looked like it was like more of one-sided. You hear about militias, you know, how aggressive they are, how violent they are, and you don't hear much about the African people, the African culture, or what is really happening, you know, at the grassroots level. Then I would think to myself, I said, but I grew up in these areas, but I never really had even, sometimes you wouldn't trust the government,
yeah.
Because the government would send the soldiers, and then everybody would have to duck to the bush,
yeah.
And something
yeah.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that actually made me to now start thinking about alternative peace-building methods, you know. So apart from the United Nations and all these other big ideas of peace-building, you know, negotiation, you know, mediation and all that. So I started looking at that from the lens of the African people, the cultural perspective. So my research is mainly on the indigenous knowledge on peace-building. Yeah. So, yeah, I think that's pretty much
yeah.
about it. I've put in a lot as
such. Yeah, no, that's very, yeah. That's really true.
Yeah.
So part for, I love about your, yeah. is it's that lens
yeah.
and that sort of thinking about culture
yeah.
and lives
yeah.
and what happens in that.
Yeah.
Why do you think it is difficult for those perspectives and those voices to be heard? Like, so in the news that you hear, it's only about forces and...
So that, I think, takes me back to... I actually sometimes want to run away from colonialism.
Yeah.
But sometimes you can't run away from it.
No.
Okay. So there's what they call knowledge production.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there has been this knowledge production where the West is the one that produces knowledge. So since colonialism, it's like the West who go to Africa or go to these places of conflict and they produce knowledge about those issues, about those conflicts. So you know about research. You know, you have to kind of steer your kind of thinking along with your funder. You know, sometimes your funder will tell you exactly what they want you to go and research on, and that's the language and that's the kind of ideas you'll have to bring forth. So a lot of times knowledge production has been so much controlled that way, such that when the West goes to research about some of these places or some of these issues, they are only researching on the ideas that they are familiar with. You know?
Yeah.
So,
and from those same institutions
yeah.
that are funding and
yeah.
sending them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, that then makes it like the same narrative continues. You know?
Yeah.
Same narrative
yeah.
of.
So, it's a bit like
not
yeah.
hearing the other voices, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. So, you only see
yeah.
what you expect to see.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So without those voices, it's a...
Yeah, without those voices, it becomes like, I don't know, it's not balanced. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's there's somebody called, I don't know whether you know about her, she's called Adichie Gozie or somebody.
Okay.
She writes about a single-sided story or single story. Where, you know, when she looks at the many stories that have been told about, you know, she's from Nigeria, Biafran, all that, it's like a single-sided story. You know, so I think now we are at a point where we need to, like what you're doing, like we need to draw from the other part of the world and hear their own stories.
Mm.
You know, my understanding of conflict and peace building might be a little bit different from yours because I had that lived experiences. Like, for example, when you talk about safe places, I don't know whether I've gone ahead
yes.
with you. When you talk about,
yeah, tell
you
us
know,
about that whole, yeah,
safe places. And I'm like, so what do you mean by safe places? You
that
know?
Is a really good question.
Yeah. For you are going to think probably about the police,
mm-hmm.
you know, about the army, you know, maybe about maybe school heads or, well, you always talk about civil society.
Yeah.
Now, I go back and look at what was happening at that point where police were actually not there as well, you
yeah.
know. The government is not there.
Mm-hmm.
It might be even the clan itself, because usually in rural areas it's like the chiefs and the clans who kind of should be able to take control of like sort of security. Now, again, it depends from community to community. There are those communities that are like cattle rearing communities, like the Dinka that I write about, the Dinka, the Nuer. They have trained their own young people, including girls, to fight, you know, at the same time to provide security for the community. So, but in other communities, these kind of arrangements are not there. So what does somebody do? You know, if you're in a community or you're in a place that there's no police, mm-hmm. there's no military, maybe there's no... remember in some of these places, sometimes the chiefs no longer function like they used to do because of the wars that have gone. The militias are more stronger than them, and sometimes the militias actually terrorize the chiefs as well. So they cannot function. They are not in control.
So, yeah, that's interesting. So you're saying, like, this, the idea of safe space, yeah. of creating it, like, with the police force and making it safe, that we might think of here, doesn't exist in the same way, because
it doesn't exist in the same way. So what I'm then going back to is, so what used to happen? What was my experience? It was like, so... Every family has to decide what's good for them.
Okay.
My mother, for example, many times, you know, people would run into the bush. Of course, villagers, people go into the bush. And actually, what I would say is like environment actually plays a very big role, you know, for people who are doing climate. I don't know whether there are people who are doing climate, degrees in climate here and all that, climate change and issues. Environment plays a very big role in safety, you know, as opposed to when you look at the structures. Here or in the modern world, like right now, if you look at the war that's going on in Israel, you know, the Hamas, you see those bunkers there, you know, they dug them and they were hiding under those bunkers, and that's their safety, right? In areas where there is no enough money to build up these structures, then that means people are going to kind of depend on the resources that they have. And what is that then? That's the environment. Okay, so now you see people like myself, with, you know, little ones with the mother dashing into the bush. You have to look for the biggest bush, you know.
Okay, yeah, where you can actually hide.
Well, yes, where you can hide. Sometimes under the rocks.
So would that be your mother saying, yes, come on,
we got to run, and then we hide. Then it was not only my other mothers were doing it.
Everybody runs.
If somebody was near the lake, you know, there are also small islands in the lake there, so you have to take a boat and then get into that island and hide there, you know. Yeah. So the environment plays a big role. If you look at, for example, the Nuer, I research about the Nuer, I talk about them in my work. They too have like sort of a river in South Sudan. There's a river that kind of curves around. And that has helped them actually in terms of protecting them. Because when the outsiders come to fight, you know, other ethnic groups, they are kind of stopped by that river.
Oh, so they're on one side and the people trying to...
Yeah, if there's no boat, how are you going to cross to the other community?
Okay, so make sure you take your boats with you.
Yeah, that's what happens here.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the kind of structure that kind of presents itself here, or maybe what we are seeing in the Middle East where the bunkers are really well set and all that, it's not the kind of, you know... safe zone that we might think about in some other parts of the world where the structures are not even there.
Interesting. So I really like the idea. So I don't think we think enough about environment and place when we think about safety, because we do think more about institutions. Mm. But essentially, when you first said, oh, I think differently about safety, one thing I thought of is this idea that there isn't safety in a sense. It might be a bit safer, but you're still this idea of safety is actually quite complicated.
It is complicated, but saying that, you know, environment. Well, of course, there are those risks as well. You know, environment is not that safe, if I may say, because I remember this one particular night that we dashed. You know, hearing gunshots, you dash into the bush.
Yeah.
And then lay those mats around sleep. In the morning, there is a snake skin. You know, the snake just shelled itself somewhere there, 2 meters away.
And so it was not far.
Mom saw it, and that was the last time we were in that bush.
Okay.
So the next time she had to prepare another bush in the farm now, because there was a large farm, and yeah. in the middle of it there were bushes. So at least there it was a little bit safer.
Yeah.
So then what happens in there is that she brings in a pot of water.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So then she brings in like flour, cornmeal flour. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether you guys know cornmeal flour. Like you set up yourself for the next, you know.
You the know, next time you come fight.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
So there is water, there is dry food, there is beans, there is firewood in there. So the way the tree was, it's really an overgrown tree side, the canopy is that you can't actually see out there. And it's really a big farm. So if somebody is passing on the road, they are not going to even think that there are people in there. You know. So that was actually the safest place.
Under a tree.
To make it actually even much better, other villagers started coming in to the same place whenever they hear gunshots. And because now nobody has to be running around everywhere. No, mm-hmm. She said, children, when you hear gunshots,
you go to that place. That tree.
So, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So it's actually thinking in advance what's going to happen.
Yeah.
So because your mother put the water and the food and the mats and stuff so you could run.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very interesting. So interesting.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, what's happening in... I know you're also working across in Uganda where you were brought up as well. So what's happening in South Sudan and Uganda at the moment that's... in this, I mean, are people managing to use more of their... strengthening the clans and more traditional conflict resolution? I know people are still running and are still displaced and still it's unsafe for many people, but
so think about it this way, because there are some structures that are in place, and some people of course run to the refugee centers. You know, we know that in northern Uganda, for example, there are refugee centers. So there are those refugees from South Sudan who have run to northern Uganda, and now there is war again in the Sudan, the northern part of Sudan, and those people have, some of them have run back to South Sudan and then to the neighboring countries. So when you look at it, it's like, I don't know whether, you know, because even in the refugee camps themselves, it's not safe sometimes, you know, because if you look at the, I think I read one of your papers sometime back that talks about some of the things and then the humanitarian, you know, interventions and all that. Yes, when they come in, the UN, for example, they establish some of these centers, but sometimes they are not really very safe, because sometimes they don't actually have enough within the center itself. Like we've talked about issues to do with water, food, firewood, you know. Remember, sometimes I think firewood, because firewood they use it for cooking, for, you know, source of fuel. So then women have to leave the camp and go collect firewood. So if there's nobody to guard them, women can easily be attacked.
They can.
Something like that. So then if you look at it that way, the places that are kind of set up by the United Nations might not necessarily even be safe, even within the camp itself.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes the safety is not up. So, yeah, so, but yeah, majority of the times then, I think within the camps you can claim that it's relatively safe.
So it's safer but than maybe where you're
from. Than maybe hiding in the bush and all that. But bear in mind that there are some people actually who wouldn't want to leave, especially the elderly people.
Yes.
You know, what I notice is that the elderly people actually, time comes when they kind of, they can't even be bothered.
They just don't know.
Like, I remember recently we're doing that research in the villages. There's this old man, he's 78, he never goes anywhere. Whether the biggest gunshot, whatever it is,
just
wants to stay.
Yeah.
Say, let them kill me, I've had enough.
Wow. That is a different way of thinking about displacement.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of people on the move.
Yes, of course, people move. Because then, much as I say that environment helps in the rural settings, you cannot progress. You know, imagine you're always hiding. You're always in the bush, maybe 2-3 times a week you're hiding. And it can become, it's like, can't be sustainable. One reason, one way or the other, you somehow have to leave the village. So that's why people are migrating to some other parts of the world or to the refugee camps, etc. You know, to be able to continue with their lives.
Yeah, and rebuild communities,
and things
like that.
Yeah.
So... well, I know you began by being so interested in what had happened to you and what was happening with the sort of traditional leaders and clans. What do you focus on now? How are you building that? What's interesting around?
Yeah. Okay, just again, I think what I'm doing now, I'm still doing local peace building, right? But I'm mostly looking at conflicts that stem from issues to do with, like, for example, land conflicts, you know, land conflicts.
Between different clans
or different individuals. And
are those conflicts often violent?
Sometimes, but not like group. Sometimes it's
not like
family. Like family levels, etc. And then maybe women get caught up in that. Sometimes some women have ended up like killing. Maybe killing their husband, killing the husband's brother or something because of land dispute or something. And then we're dealing with the issues of women empowerment as well, to see areas of marginalizations and see how to help understand the whole issue of where the clan is. In fact, where the clan is right now is, I don't think it's like it used to be. You know, a lot has happened such that the clan doesn't seem to be really directly responsible for what is happening.
Okay.
Because with the interviews that we've had on women when we're doing this project on understanding women empowerment from the contextual perspective, you'll realize that the clan is almost not there, because women are saying, so if they have these problems, like for example land conflicts, when they go to report to the clan head or clan leader, sometimes they call a meeting and talk about it, but at times they don't really talk about it
because the clan leaders aren't strong enough to make agreements. Or
it's like what they said was like they want to leave each person with their family now. It's no longer like it used to be. Remember the spirit of Ubuntu, togetherness, and all that. They like kind of individualism are setting.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Everybody looks after the
family. So the cultures are really changing.
The culture is changing.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's very interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
So what would you say to those who are talking about? I don't know. I mean, maybe you want. What are the traditional mechanisms that clans would have used to resolve these conflicts?
I think they would still, you know, like, was it Diana Francis says that peace out there should be built by the people who live there, right? The clan still has a responsibility to really talk, you know, to get people to talk about peace building, you know, talk about things that help community build peace. There are many ways of doing this, and the way, many ways still do work, you know, issues to do with getting people to talk, you know, dialogue, mediation, dialogue. And of course, at the grassroots level, things to do with like storytelling, you know, people coming into
how you reproduce the narratives and the culture.
Telling their own stories. And then, of course, practices like, for example, having food there, you know, when the negotiation has stopped, people eat food, people talk, you know, discuss issues. And then others would include, like, for example, intermarriages that still should take place in some places. But generally, because now there's a lot of course, Western influence, you know. Mm. One other thing that I came across when I was doing that research recently was that they now call, like, the millennials, we call them here, they call them the .com.
No!
the .com.
The .com generation.
The .com generation. So they don't listen to us. That's what mothers are saying. The .com generation, they don't listen to us.
Because they have access to WhatsApp,
you know. So they're very concerned, actually, about the .com generation, because like it used to be, like, there was actually almost no drugs, you know, no smoking and all that. But those things are now in the community, deep down in rural areas. A little bit used to exist in, like, urban settings, in the cities.
Yes.
But now, even in rural areas. So the young men are into drugs now, you know. They are smoking. They cannot listen to their mothers. When the mothers report it, the dads actually are out there always drinking.
There's a lot of harm within the community.
Yeah, within the community, not just the political. You might think maybe it's because the area that I was researching on is a post-conflict zone.
Yeah.
I don't know. Is it the baggage from that?
Because of so many years of trauma. Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. But definitely trauma must be playing a part in how people react to what's going on.
Yeah.
So. Wow, very interesting. Are things like the African Union interested in all of this? I mean, I know obviously they deal with the institutional level of peace and security, but...
Yes, yeah, I would say African Union is interested because that's why it was set up,
yeah,
you know. But remember, African Union is a brainchild of United Nations, right?
Yes.
And you
very
know that,
modeled on
yes,
it, isn't
modeled.
It? Yeah,
so
yeah.
African Union cannot work on its own. Mm-hmm. African Union listens from the United Nations. United Nations is sponsored by different people who have different interests.
Yeah.
You know, so peace building now becomes like a capitalist-led kind of idea. You know,
yeah.
it's a profit-making
back
idea
into the industry,
back into the industry and something. So African Union work. I think recently they set up a department for indigenous knowledge of something mm-hmm. to do with, because they're also trying to come up with this narrative of decolonizing. You know. Decolonizing and all that, but I don't think African Union is very effective.
Okay.
That's all I have to say. Yeah. I don't think it's very effective. No.
No.
Yeah.
So it's back down to people.
It's back down to the people. To the consumer. Yeah.
So if you were to think of like one or two or a few things going forward, I mean, the complexity and the number of issues facing people across Sudan, South Sudan, Uganda. All of those are so complicated, but people are trying and are creating things, systems that work for them.
Yeah. You know, my thinking now is, I think there is a lot that we don't know about women. We don't know about those women who are always there with the, looking after the family, at the same time trying to negotiate their ways through, you know, conflict and etc. So a lot of research, I think, has to be done on women, you know, resiliences and all that. Try to understand them, you know, how do they manage, how do they survive? Because a lot of times we've looked at issues to do with, you know, when you talk about women empowerment, they're always saying that women in the sub-Saharan zones are not empowered, you know. But if you look at it, it's like they're comparing women in the sub-Saharan with the women in the West, you know. But we're trying to understand empowerment within that
Absolutely.
Zone, you know.
Yeah.
So I think a lot has to be done on researching on these women, finding out how they're managing, and probably trying to conceptualize whatever we're trying to talk about, whether it's security and all that, based on their own understanding and maybe draw from that and build bigger concepts or build bigger structures from those.
So sometimes when I think about women and that sort of like protection and what does safety mean, and it's like for a lot of women, part of the safety is safety in their own home, as well as safety on the street and family and as well as maybe being interested and concerned about the political aspect, but it starts from home, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I think for the local people, you know, back in, you know, in countries, in the sub-Saharan countries, it's very difficult for somebody to think of broader ideas of security, you know, of safety.
Yeah.
They have to deal with what they have, you know. So I think those are the ones that if we could help them develop, you know, maybe, and convince the United Nations, convince African Union to adopt them.
And so do you manage to bring some of this into your teaching? I know it's obviously a big part of what you research.
Yeah, of course. Actually, there's something that I'm doing on, I think you might remember this very well. I've never written about it again after my PhD. I talk about Locate You. You heard about Locate You. It's a pregnancy belt for people. I don't know if anybody has been to Kenya. So Locate You is a belt that's worn by women from mostly Kenya. So, but not the whole of Kenya, the Maasai, the Pokot women. It's supposed to be, it translates as a pregnancy belt. But it's more than a pregnancy, it's symbolic, you know. So once the woman, in fact, it's handed over to a girl, a bride, when she's joining her home now, when she's married. And she's, so she's got to wear that belt at all times. You know, especially when she's conceived, she has to wear that belt.
Wow.
She doesn't remove it. Now, when she's pregnant, she's until she gives birth, she will not receive. Now, the significance, the symbolic aspect of it is that belt as well, they think it's protective of the fetus.
Wow.
Protective, and actually the squabbles, you know, family squabbles, and they believe that when a mother removes that belt, there will be a lot of family squabbles.
So it's protecting the family as well as the baby.
Yes. Interestingly, when there are like inter-ethnic conflicts,
yeah,
women can then, if they want that conflict to go ahead, they will not remove, they'll just keep their own. But if they want to stop their men, like for example, there was this, the Pokot men going to attack the neighbors, mm-hmm. the Marakwet. So the women had to remove their belts and then put it along the
wow.
along the roots. Yeah? The roots that these are, their own men,
to,
yes, their
yeah.
own men were going to attack.
Yeah.
They didn't want it because they're tired of the,
yeah.
and then they removed their belts and put their. And when the men go out there, you know, their sons and husbands go, and then they see this bell, they come back.
Wow.
They don't go to war. So we could say that is a safety.
That is definitely that's both safety and conflict resolution. That's
yes.
stopping, that's the escalation.
Yeah,
that's fantastic.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Actually, I look at it as deterrence as well.
Deterrence
I'm
as well.
Really, I'm
yeah.
really I've just said
so
many
things
many
those
things,
women
yeah.
achieved.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That's
yeah.
amazing. I love the richness of all of that because
yeah.
it's so different from learning a framework and
yeah.
a blueprint and
yeah.
stuff like that. This
yeah.
is what
yeah.
people do.
What people do. So
yeah.
I'm actually using that concept to write about deterrence, you know, try to interpret deterrence theory
yeah.
From the locatio kind
yeah.
of perspective, yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. yeah.
Wow, thank you very much.
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
fun.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
really interesting.
Yeah.
And I really love how you weave all the stories
yeah.
into thinking about the bigger challenge of peace, really.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Like, recently I was talking to a colleague who knows actually somebody who is doing peace building
mm-hmm.
in Sudan. Now, what they are doing is they call people and they expect people to just talk, discuss, negotiate, and then that's it. So, the person who is kind of facilitating this usually can't understand why after a few months, again, she has to come back to do the same thing.
Okay.
You know. But again, another thing is, whenever they are doing this kind of negotiation and the meetings,
mm-hmm.
right, when there is a break, time for a break, she goes out for a break, people burst out singing.
Really?
Yes, they'll burst out singing. And
fantastic.
I don't understand, why are they singing?
Yeah.
You know, then somebody is telling, but that is how they build peace, you know, because they are singing a peace song.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
yeah.
So, then she was like, her perspective of just telling people to talk and sign the agreements was like, you know.
Just a little bit of it.
little bit of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that really reminds me of sort of like when we talk about, so in South Sudan there's the women protection teams,
yeah.
So like all the women who work in their own villages
yeah.
and
yes.
POC camps.
Yeah.
And again, one of my lovely things is when you look at the way they work,
yeah, yeah.
their devices that they use, the
yeah.
way they work,
yeah.
it's all about song and dance and
yeah.
community meetings.
Yeah.
So their meetings are singing,
yeah.
they communicate to the other people in their villages.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
that.
And actually, if you listen to those songs, if you understand the language, ask them to interpret for you the song. They're actually singing about the issue. They,
that's
you can,
right,
you can
yeah.
actually even start your research on those songs and try to understand the meaning and. And this is the missing link, you know, when we talk about indigenous knowledge and all that, when we talk about decolonizing. For the UN and the United Nations, I mean, African Union,
yeah.
they've never really involved these kind of things like the songs, like poetry and all that. But this is what makes meaning to the people who are fighting, you know.
Yeah.
This is what they understand better. When it comes to just signing agreements, they don't understand that. Look at South Sudan. How many agreements have they signed?
Many.
How many agreements? And why doesn't it work? These agreements work in the West. Yeah?
Yeah.
But in other parts of the world, it doesn't work because they don't understand. For them, it's just a paper. You know? For them, the meaning comes from the cultural practices. You know, songs, poems, stories, and then maybe the intervention of elders. The elders can be in there to help resolve this issue.
Yeah, so the indigenous knowledge is hard, and that's for peace building, but
yeah.
I think there's also a big move around indigenous voices within the climate crisis as
yeah.
well,
yeah.
because the way you experience it and what happens
yes.
to you
yeah. Yeah.
isn't
yeah.
told in policy papers, it's told in the stories.
Yeah, it's told in the story. It reminds me of, there's this group, one of the groups that I research on, they are called Acholi. So, the Acholi, for them, I think they used to know about this even long time ago, environment and all that, said that when they are cleaning the well areas of the spring wells and all that, you know, there's always little fishes in there. So everybody gathers to go and clean. They kind of select a day and say everybody's communal work and everybody must go. If you don't go, they can come and raid you, you know, maybe pick your chicken or goat and all that. And you know, these are assets to somebody, so you don't want them taken. So everybody goes to help with the clearing of the well, or maybe if it's a road, you know, everybody goes well. But with the particular one in the well, you don't have to, because the fish is always there. So they remove the fish and then clear away the weeds and then put the fish back.
Well,
you're not supposed to take that fish.
Yeah.
You'll have to put it
fish,
back.
Yeah.
You'll have to, they clear. And if you are seen like you try to take the fish away, you are told you're warned. But the way they understand it, they say the spirits are going to kill you or do something if you take it. But I would see this as environment
Absolutely.
Protection or something like that, because really, you can't harvest a fish from that.
Oh, absolutely,
yeah.
No, I mean, sort of like the spirits or the ancestors and things, people often talk about that. And they do call on them to protect
as
part of
nature.
Well, thank you very much
for
the richness and the bringing the sort of like actual what conflict resolution looks like in South Sudan, South Uganda and stuff like that. And for bringing yourself into this picture as well, so we really appreciate you coming and all the work that you do.
Thank you so much, Rachel, for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Come back soon.